And we would like to finish up the show of the band, which plays tomorrow night at the Media Club. The name of the band is Dear Landlord. And that song called High Fives from their... actually, only a studio album called Dream Homes, released in 2009 on No Idea Records. Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you for listening. And this is Dear Landlord, High Fives. Bye bye. See you next week.
Oh, why isn't this playing? I'm trying to get a song to play. Oh, there we go. Is that gonna work? Is that gonna work? Is that gonna work? There we go. I don't think it's still working. Just sing. Just sing, Justin. Hi, you're listening to Ink Studs, CITR 101.5 FM. It's been a while since I've been in the studio, and now they have this new setup with the iPods set up, and that was a fail. Fail blog. Inkstud's
right.
Fail.
That's all right. I can say, well, actually, I really can't sing, but I'm looking for a song right now. Do you know the Henry and Glenn Forever?
Yes, definitely.
So I'm doing a one in the next issue, and it's going to be Danzig goes down to Hades, to Gades, actually, to get the soul of Rollins, who's died.
Just so folks know, Henry and Glenn Forever is a comic about Henry Rollins and Glenn Danzig as same-sex life partners.
Yeah.
And their neighbors
long-time companions.
Long-time companions, not necessarily life partners, but they're very close, and their neighbors are satanic Hall and Oates.
Yeah. So Rollins dies, and Hall and Oates actually open up a portal to Gades so that he can go down and get back Rollins, and he's going to encounter the head of Gades, who will force him to sing a show tunes, so he can actually bring his lover back. And this is like, and he's like, I'm not that kind of gay. So, but it's I'm not really either. So I actually need to research the proper show tune that Danzig would sing to bring Rollins back from the dead. So if you know,
that seems fair.
Yeah, I'm just kind of putting that out into the ether.
I'll work on that in email.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe I should do a proper introduction. This is Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM. As I said, it's been a while since I've been in the studio. Unfortunately, my life does not allow for me to be here every week. I wish I could. But this week's kind of special. Justin Hall is in town for Pride. And Justin also happened to just put out a fantastic anthology called No Straight Lines from My Fine Friends and Your Friends, Fantagraphics Books, which should be hitting stores
nowish.
Right now. Literally, like, either this week or next week. And they're making their way out there. You also just did a whole bunch of launches, including some fantastic stuff at San Diego Comic-Con, which we will get into.
Yeah.
But I also want to make sure we acknowledge our other guests who I asked to join us today. Not to up the queer content, but because specifically Ken Bozum. Ken's been on before when we've talked about we had another guest on who's doing historical work. This time it was a book about Canadian comics, and Ken has a special interest in Canadian comics. But Ken, you also have a special interest not just in Canadian comics, but...
Well, I'm also a queer cartoonist myself, so I have interest in queer cartooning, obviously, for completely self-invested interests. but I'm also into comic history generally, so I kind of, I know a bit about sort of more Vancouver, local BC queer comic history. So I guess I'm sort of Robin to your Batman today, as it were.
Two Robins in the house. It's a little...
And you were mentioning that you do like to dress up as Green Lantern, Justin. So
there you go.
I don't know. If we have some conflicts here.
Yeah,
I should have said Tomar Ray. I'm sorry.
you had to go there. All right.
Oh, this is really bringing the comics up.
Just showing that all us who are interested in independent comic books can also still...
I appreciate
it. Exactly. Can still, you know, talk the talk.
Actually, I just came across, during research for something else, I came across this, like, humor kids comic from the, I think it was the late 50s or the late 60s, called Little Tomboy.
Oh.
And I'm just like, this is actually profoundly pro-lesbian for a comic from that era. And the hilarious thing is she looks exactly like Marcy Peppermint Patty's friend.
Yeah, well, and there's no secret about Marcy and Peppermint Patty. I think that's
pretty open.
Yeah.
No, actually, if you read his bio, Patty was based on Charles Schulz's cousin, who was a tomboy, and who, if you read between the lines of the bio, was a lesbian, but he was just trying to honor his cousin by creating the character. He never meant for that to turn into this other thing.
Wow. One of Comic-Con, I think it was last year or year before, I had Paige Braddock on one of my panels, and Paige is the creative director for the Charles Schulz Foundation.
Right.
And at the end of the panel, I said, well, you know, I just wanted to also quick question about your day job and as, you know, the Charles Schulz creative director. And, you know, what's up really with Peppermint Patty and Marcy?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, you know. And everybody laughs and everything. And we left the stage, and there was Janine Schulz, actually. Yeah. And I was like, oh, whoa. I'm sorry. But she was a lovely lady and totally fine with.
I've heard some amazing stuff about Janine. Like, she likes to go bungee jumping. I've heard that, like, maybe not anymore, but I've heard, yeah, she's quite
She was wearing a very bright print kind of thing that was I kind of gutsy, you know. I think she's got some spunk.
Now, I mentioned the book, No Straight Lines.
Can I say the rest of the title?
I was going to say, don't you give us the spiel, as I'm sure you have one.
My talking point. So the whole title is No Straight Lines, Four Decades of Queer Comics. And it's essentially my attempt at doing a comprehensive anthology of LGBTQ comics. Independent, underground stuff. A couple of caveats. It's not erotic comics. These are literary queer comics. I feel like the erotica, there's, you know, an amazing amount of really wonderful queer erotic comics, and I've made some myself. I really like that stuff. But it's been better archived already by the Tom of Finland Foundation, Center of Sex and Culture, people like that.
Yeah.
It was the literary queer comics that I was most afraid of kind of losing. And then it's also specifically Western comics. I figured that manga and other Asian queer comics kind of deserve their own book. They have their own kind of internal consistencies and rules and stuff. So that's a separate book.
But you have European
stuff
in there. So it's Western, American,
and
European.
Yeah. North American, Western.
Do you find...
Even an Israeli cartoonist is in here, too.
That's right. Do you find there was, as far as those communities, there was some cultural exchange between there? I mean, beyond the obvious of Tom of Finland...
Between the erotic stuff and the
or even the literary stuff.
So definitely, there's a lot, there's definitely some crossover. Like, first, and one of the first people in the book is this guy Sean, and he was one of the early cartoonists and doing gag strips for the kind of gay newspapers and gay magazines of the like the Advocate and stuff in the 70s. And but he also spelled his name differently. He would spell it Shawn when he was doing erotic work.
Right.
So he would do erotic stuff for like Meat Men and some Drummer magazine and stuff like that. So he actually had kind of two different lives, but he was doing both that kind of work. And there's some other crossovers. I mean, I have later on in the book, I've got John Macy, who was kind of came into the scene with Neferismo, which was his book for Eros, and recently did an adaptation of Oscar Wilde's Telony and Camille, which is this kind of dark erotic underground novel that was created probably by Oscar Wilde and his friends secretly, and it actually won the Lambda Literary Award for best gay erotica.
Actually, did a reading from Telony at Queerotica probably a couple years ago.
Oh, awesome! Yeah. So, and that's a really important book, and it has, and that kind of walks that line between literary and erotic. I mean, the way I guess I would define erotica or porn is that if the primary artistic purpose of the piece is to sexually titillate or arouse, then that's what I would call erotic or porn. It can have other artistic intentions as well.
So it's like a boner meter?
Yeah, well, because you can be really turned... I mean, just because there's something that's erotic, it doesn't mean it's going to turn you on. But if that's the intention of the creator, if that's the primary artistic intention. Whereas, the page 104 or something in this book, it has a huge boner on it. It's like it's just a gigantic, image of a penis, has a condom on it, but it's...
Well, it's very...
I mean, that's not erotic, though.
It's not a sexual...
That.
Penis. It's very much.
It's an instructive penis.
It's like one of those 1950s. Yeah. Black and white.
It's a purely literary penis.
Yes.
But there is. I mean, there's some overlap between those two worlds. But I do feel like the literary stuff was really more in danger of being lost. I mean, there's been some obviously some major crossover people like Alison Bechdel and Howard Cruise. But the vast majority of this material was in danger of vanishing with the queer media ghetto that supported it.
One thing I was thinking about, actually just a couple minutes ago before we did the interview, was looking through the work, and this isn't actually specific to the book, this is a kind of an overall question, is how queer comics kind of worked as a way of portraying your own identity, especially visually.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there is any kind of factor in there. It's like, kind of like, this is how we see ourselves.
Absolutely. Alison Bechdel, in the introduction to her Houghton Mifflin collection of Dykes to Watch Out For, says specifically, she's kind of describing how she started making her strip. And she said, I wanted to make lesbians visible. And I think the fact that comics are a visual medium has this, tremendous kind of visceral impact, where people, especially young queers who are looking for identity, looking for role models, looking for possibilities in the world around them, representation, they can literally see it. And that it has a kind of a power to it that's not necessarily in prose. On the other hand, I would say that the reason that the comics are also distinctly narrative form, and that also is important because it's not just the image, but also the story.
Well, I think it's also, Ron and I sort of talked about it briefly before the show. I mentioned that I had bought a copy of a recent Kevin Keller where Kevin is sort of dancing on the beach with Veronica, and they're completely surrounded by like Betty and other straight. Well, one of the straight couples is multiracial, so I have to give them some credit. But then I bought it specifically so I could sit it next to the issue of Gay Comics I have that has a Jerry Mills cover where the Poppers characters are all hanging out on the beach and they're playing like crazy 70s disco on the boombox, and they're just being completely flamboyant, and one of them's like, do you think anybody's going to know that we're gay? And I'm like, well, nobody's going to know Kevin's for gay on that cover for sure.
I think that the difference is that this kind of material, this independent queer underground comics, is really was an internal conversation.
That's what I mean. And that's what I mean. Like, it's also, it's important not just because it's us talking about ourselves, but it's important because it's us talking about ourselves and not mm-hmm. somebody else representing us, if you know what I mean. Like, it's not...
And, yeah. and in the past, I mean, if a comic had a queer character at all, I think it meant that it was a queer comic because the mainstream wouldn't touch this material or these characters or subject matter. But now that's different, obviously, with you know, gay Archie characters and lesbian Batwoman and you know, stuff like that. But it's not the, it's still the job of the mainstream to kind of assimilate and include queer characters. It's not their job to kind of analyze and dissect and poke fun at and think more in a more complex way about queer identities and realities.
Well, even looking back at, like, I've been going through a lot of older Golden Age material lately, and, like, there are, it's not that there's no queer content, it's that when it's there, it's like looking at an old movie. Mm-hmm. It's a flamboyantly gay waiter, or it's, like, a tomboy character, or it's that kind of thing. Like, and so it's there... very surreptitiously.
Yeah, yeah. And who knows whether the creators themselves that created that stuff were queer. I mean, it's one of the things, you know, you look back at the the early, these early queer independent comics, and, you know, part of it was just trying to figure out who was actually queer in the comics industry, mm-hmm. because that was impossible to gauge when everyone was closeted. Yeah. But you know, there, you know, before that time period, before Stonewall and everything, I mean, you know, certainly a lot of movies and probably a lot of comics had these kind of, you know, hidden little references and stuff, maybe created by queer people or maybe just derogatory, you know.
Well, to some degree, they're kind of like the gay or lesbian version of a Stephen Fetchett character for the black community.
Yes,
like, it's,
right.
you know,
yeah.
yeah.
What a great highlight to leave on. I was looking through some photos on the old Facebook, referencing modern technology for those of you, of the queer panel at San Diego. Mm. And I found it really exciting to see, like, just the kind of the range of folks that are involved in that. Is that something, as you're doing this book, or maybe it's just something from your own community involvement, just getting to know more of, like, who is out there and creating these community connections?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a pretty remarkable shift in the last 10 years, I would say. I mean, you know, Andy Mangels had a Gays and Comics panel at Comic-Con for 25 years. It actually just celebrated its 25th year. But the last 10 years, I think we've really seen this kind of... real inclusion and growth of kind of queer themes and characters and kind of out creators and also you know, straight and cisgender creators now, using characters that who are marginalized normally. So it's been a huge shift in the last 10 years. And we've been able to do all the different kinds of panels. So it's, you know, and be more specific about the panels. Like, it's no longer enough to simply have a gays and comics panel. And now you have to be more specific about what you're talking about. So, you know, we've had, like, you know, a panel on, you know, whether you can have, you know, villains in, you know, queer villains in comics, for example, or panels on, you know, queer women, specific queer women issues or something. You can get more specific now, which is nice, you know, because it's broadened out enough.
It's interesting to look at. I totally just derailed myself.
Where's that music?
Yeah. Just a reminder, folks, you can call in 604-822-2487 if you want to ask a question. No, one of the things I was looking at is how work has kind of changed topically and especially looking in your book, as because it's a survey over time, and I'm wondering the work you chose in there to kind of represent points of time, is this a reflection of the material you're coming out with, that you're coming across, or is this something specific you wanted to kind of get across to represent that point?
Well, I guess there were kind of... I mean, when I look at the whole collection, of course, there ends up being kind of, you know, whether I want it to happen or not, a kind of editorial, you know, direction or kind of flavor to it, you know. But I kind of approached it with three different categories, which would be the first one is artistic merit. I mean, that has to be good material. Then would be historical merit, and then representational merit. So I did want to, you know, I want to have these good stories out there that anyone could kind of enjoy and be, and, you know, captivated by, and then if they want to see more of it, they can do some research. But then I also wanted it to kind of be a historical overview to a certain extent of the kinds of material that was being produced, and then, of course, you know, by whom, by the kind of the representational merit. So. So yeah, I was looking at all those kinds of things as I was putting the collection together and trying to figure out, and you know, and we even I broke it up into three sections to kind of give it a storyline, essentially. So the first section is, let me see, the first section is Comics Come Out, Gay Gag Strips, Underground Comics with an X, and Lesbian Literati. And the second one is File Under Queer, Comics to Comics, Punk Zines, and Art During the Plague. And the third one is A New Millennium, Trans Creators, Web Comics, and Stepping Out of the Ghetto. So each one of those kind of has a thematic arc to it. The first one is obviously about the kind of initial, you know, fight for visibility and representation and the very early comics that were coming out of both the gay newspapers and magazines from the queer ghetto, and also from the lesbian and feminist underground comics from the 70s. People like Trina Robbins and then Mary Wings and Roberta Gregory. And then, you know, kind of culminating in the gay comics anthology. And then the second section is you know, going into the zine culture. You know, a lot of stuff came out of the punk zines. Work like Kata Paisan, Homicidal Lesbian Terrorist, and then also the kind of next wave of comic strips, such as Alison Bechdel's Dykes to Watch Out For, and Wendell by Howard Cruz, and then also response to AIDS. I mean, that was a huge kind of cultural thing that was happening at the same time. And then the third one is about kind of this emergence of trans creators, openly trans creators, which is I think a big and important development. And then web comics, where everything kind of shifts. Publication technologies, and then also the possibility now for queer narratives and queer comics to kind of step into a mainstream of publishing and not just exist in a ghetto.
Hothead Paisan was actually one of the comics that was seized by Canada Customs.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? For Little Sisters?
Yeah.
Wow. It's pretty radical.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah, no, it is. I mean,
it tells you to take an axe to the patriarchy.
I mean, yeah, you know? No, it's true. It's true. But yeah.
It's... I'm wondering if we want to comment at all on the challenges, especially in Canada, Vancouver, of kind of getting a hold of these queer works, of gay and lesbian comics here at somewhere like Little Sisters.
Well, in terms of sort of Vancouver queer comic history, Rand Holmes, we talked about a little bit before the show, who did cover for the first issue of Gay Comics, also did Harold Head for the Tortoise Strait. So he's kind of like the big local historical kind of, I guess, queer connection. But we didn't, except for imported magazines, there wasn't really a whole lot of local cartooning or comic stuff going on until I would say like the 70s, 80s-ish. And then by the mid or early 80s, there's a lot of community newspapers and magazines and stuff. So you get people like Sheila Smart and who else? Tika, somebody else who was doing sort of a trans character called The Collected Adventures of Super Ho. Sheila Smart actually did a really fun strip about a lesbian named Susan that was just kind of like a slice of life strip, but it was really cleverly done. And Sean Martin, they used to do Dock and Raider, used to live in Vancouver, so he used to do that. So there was like local stuff that definitely commented on local issues. So say like when the Gay Games were here in 1990, like there was at least three different comic strips going on at the time that all commented on stuff going on or that kind of thing.
The Gay Games? I think you need to inform me of this.
Well, they were supposed to be called the Gay Olympics, but the Olympics actually, they actually sued them, and they had to change it to Gay Games.
Yeah,
not Gay Olympics.
No, and Laugh Olympic was taken. So
they allow Olympics to be used in pretty much every other group, but not for gay.
But not for gay. Yeah. We weren't special enough.
No, no, we're more special.
We're more special
because they didn't allow it.
We were that special. So was it Gay Games 3? I think it was Gay Games 3 was in Vancouver, which was actually a big, historically, a sort of a big growing up moment for the gay community here, too, because it was the first time that sort of the world of gay came to Vancouver for something. And it was the first time a lot of gay people in Vancouver suddenly were bombarded by thousands, literally tens of thousands of other people like themselves. And we kind of took over the city for the week or two that it was going on, which was really empowering for a lot of people in Vancouver, I think. But yeah, so it really mostly just sort of bubbled up from smaller local things. So like, I did a college strip in the early 90s where two guys kissed and I got a death threat. So like,
what?
Yeah, in Kelowna, in the Okanagan. It said something about my first sinuous displays of homosexuality and something about me praying to the Almighty. And yeah.
Didn't work.
Didn't work. No, I'm still here. I'm still here. I'm still drawing comics where guys make out and stuff. Yeah.
Well, it is interesting about how like a lot of queer comics are they oftentimes have a local flavor because they tend to be so much for a community, you know, made by a member of a community for a community, and not necessarily for kind of wider distribution and a wider audience.
Although I actually, I don't know, I sort of fall in a different place on the locality of setting. Because I'm like, you know, I mean, how many of us have ever, not all of us have been to New York, but we can all sit and watch a show that's set in New York and not bat an eye about it. But then if you set it in some other place that everybody hasn't watched a sitcom based in, then we're supposed to think that there's no way anybody could ever wrap their heads around that.
Yeah.
I'm like, people in Taiwan watch Coronation Street and get the jokes. Like, it's from the north of England. It's very different from Taiwan. So, but I do get the point about, like, sort of local versus bigger as well.
Well, so, like, even, like, Ren Holmes, I mean, he looked, his comics look like Vancouver in the
70s. Well, there's Vancouver in the
70s. Yeah, that's it, right?
They were even more specific because he was specifically making fun of the mayor here and specific police officers here, like by name, like he was mocking them.
a lot of the queer comics that I ran across tended to be specifically about San Francisco or New York, because a lot of this stuff was coming out of those two locales. And you see a lot of very specific stuff about the Castro neighborhood and the Chelsea neighborhood.
I think part of that too is just because it's the comics themselves are about your lived experience, and that's where your lived experience is happening when you're creating it, right?
So, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And a focal point of community. I mean, you know, the reality is that that's, you know, where gay culture was kind of being developed. It was in these kind of urban centers, you know, sprinkled throughout.
Coastal cities where all the soldiers came back from the war.
All the sailors.
Rosie the Riveters were.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Having a good time with each other.
Yeah. Totally. Good times.
No, we're going to do a quick song break. I think we're going to listen to, was it Dolatoria? Dolatora?
Dolorada?
Dolorada.
Okay.
Man, I am just no good today. And then for the next couple seconds, these guys are going to make fun of me for everything I've gotten wrong.
No, we wouldn't.
No, that would be wrong.
All right. Come on. It's been a while since I've been on MySpace. How does this thing work?
Message. I
And we're back. Inkstud, CITR. MySpace.
That was, by the way, Dolorata. It was like a dyke rock band from San Francisco. Love them. They're amazing. FYI. That's my plug.
We're trying to stay themed here today on the studs. One thing I was kind of spieling about these guys earlier is I'm not doing this because it's Pride weekend. I'm doing this because you're in town. But then you corrected me like, well, it's important. What you say, what you said to me, which was really well spoken.
I have no idea if I said that coherently or not before. But I know it's important to celebrate, to like, you know, it's Pride. It's we should be celebrating queerness and all of its wonderful guises and artistic expressions. And it's absolutely appropriate to have a Inkstud's show. By the way, the Inkstud's is a really gay name. I just got to say,
it is pretty gay.
It's kind of gay. And I will say that my boyfriend, I think I mentioned this to you before, that my boyfriend was a little bit annoyed because he's heavily tattooed. He's completely covered in tattoos. And so he's usually used to being thought of as the Inkstud. And he was like, what, you get to be on Inkstud? What's that? So I'm just saying.
I am appropriating it from Dan Clowes, who got it from someone else. It was in an issue of 8-Ball.
Okay.
Where, you know, like...
I figured there had to be a pedigree to it.
I'm going to go high. Yeah. and I'm working on finding out where the name came from. And I will definitely acknowledge the homoerotic connotations to the name. And just a reminder, folks, I'm joined by Justin Hall and Ken Bozum, and we're talking about Justin's new book, No Straight Lines, 4 Decades of Queer Comics. Why don't we talk about 4 decades? What is it important, like, about early 1970s that we're seeing this work come out then? And there's some work predating that, but
yeah, very little,
minuscule.
Yeah,
making hand gestures in the radio.
I'm getting it. I mean, it's kind of an interesting, I don't know, twist of fate or whatever, that kind of queer, the modern queer rights movement essentially mirrors kind of modern developments of comics. You know, so in 1969 is the Stonewall Riots. At the same, you know, around the same time, Zap Comics number one comes out in San Francisco. So same location that these movements are happening in the same time period. And they have this kind of interesting parallel for the next 4 decades, where queer visibility and queer rights become more and more, you know, accepted and more mainstream, and they go through these different permutations, as comics are doing the same thing, you know. But they're both kind of, it's a marginalized community using a marginalized art form, which is, so I start the essay in the book out with this quote from Jerry Mills, who is who did the strip Poppers, which is this wonderful gay comic.
And what are Poppers?
Poppers are a magic gay elixir.
I think that's good.
Or a tape cleaner.
Yes. A couple of years ago, I think it was the New York Times did this like guide for straight people for gay pride. And one of the tips was, if anybody comes and rubs a small bottle, brown bottle, under your nose, do not under any circumstances inhale. This is a magical gay elixir. It's called Poppers. It is only for us. It is not for you.
That's kind of unfair. What about,
I think it's
all
unfair,
the,
too.
All the straight men who want to get pegged and all
it's,
the...
No,
know,
it's true.
I mean, you know, it should,
it's
anyway.
True.
It, they give me a headache.
And there are more
than myself.
There are more and more of those.
It's true. And they just gave me a headache, so I'm staying away from it. Yeah. But all right. So the
but
journey
of the strip.
Yes. And mind you, the strip not only was it named Poppers, but also had a kind of running a short piece underneath it, like ran underneath the page that was the adventures of the crab that, you know, the crabs that live in his crotch.
In his crotch. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it was definitely but it's beautiful. It's anyway. So it says, comics and gays, they go together well. After all, they have one major thing in common. Both tend to not get any respect. So, you know, I think that's, there was this sense by these early queer cartoonists that we're a marginalized community using a disrespected art form to kind of say, you know, talk about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the work that came out, talk about the underground section, mm-hmm. and then the 80s, mm-hmm. And you start out with the, and I'm totally going to mispronounce his name, the David Wajnarowicz.
Wajnarowicz.
Yeah. Thank you. You can just say it for me. And that spread about being infected with HIV, and it's kind of like
you kind of have like all this like crazy stuff coming from different directions, and you get to this point, and it's almost like a punch to the gut.
Yeah, that's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
I mean, very deliberately. And I mean, the book was published actually by DC, which is shocking, and is very much out of print.
Fantagraphics is republishing it.
So, yeah, I'm very excited about that. It's a beautiful piece of work. It was illustrated by James Romberger and Marguerite Van Cook. And it was published posthumously after David had already died. And from his... I mean, he wrote a book called 7 Miles a Second, which is... amazing. I mean, he's primarily known as a visual artist, I mean, as a fine artist. But he also wrote this memoir about essentially dying of AIDS and adapted into a comic book form, and which was eventually published after his death. And it brings you back to that time period of, you know, people were dying and there was no recourse and there was no one really, you know, and the backlash was so horrendous, you know, that people kind of, you know, the dominant culture was just letting people die. I mean, essentially, it's hard to kind of almost remember that. So I wanted the beginning of that section to be a punch in the gut. I wanted people to remember the rage and the fear and the anger and the and all that.
That was one of the things at the beginning with the book seizures at Little Sister's bookstore as well, is that a lot of the stuff that was being seized was gay magazines, and that was where most of the safer sex info was coming from in the early years. So that, if it came into the country, would arrive with that section completely blacked out, because you couldn't make any reference to anal sex, because that meant it might happen, or somebody was doing it, and that was illegal and wrong, and that couldn't happen. And so they literally would have to get on the phone to somebody in the States and say, can you turn to page, like, 13? Can you read to us where it says safer sex guidelines? Can you read to that so we can copy it down and photocopy it and spread it?
That is...
like, it's just insane. It's
incredibly disturbing. You mentioned the gay newspapers and magazines, and I should go back to what one thing you asked before, Robin, about why was this moment in time? After Stonewall, there was an explosion of kind of queer magazines and newspapers and periodicals. So, like, The Advocate started in 1967 as a community newsletter and became an actual magazine, I think, in 69 or 70. And it's the longest running. But there, you know, there was this explosion of gay newspapers and local papers and stuff. And they wanted comics. So that was really kind of drove the initial boom of queer comics. And then, you know, another current came in later, which was the kind of lesbian feminist underground comics with an X, you know, coming from that.
Also, I think, was kind of an outgrowth of that, because kind of what happened was the movement sort of started, the sort of voices of the movement, whether they were paper or radio or whatever, sort of took place. And then, as in most movements, a lot of the women within a movement started feeling they were being disenfranchised. They were being asked to make the coffee. They were being asked to sort of plan the meetings, but not really do any of the work or be involved. And then they sort of said, well, we're going to take our bus and go over here then. And then that led to a whole bunch of, like, women's publications and women's magazines. Mm-hmm. So, like Kinesis here was, like, a feminist magazine, but they had, like, a lesbian comic strip or that kind of thing.
Right. It was also, I put in Trina Robbins' Sandy Comes Out, which in a lot of ways kind of, I feel this really kind of started a lot of literary queer comics, because it was the first comic about a queer person that was not derogatory and not a gag strip and not erotic. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a funny story. It was, so Trina herself is straight, but she, at the time in 69, Sandy Crum, who was Robert Crumb's sister, comes into San Francisco, moves to San Francisco, divorces her husband, and moves to San Francisco with her baby and moves in with Robert and his wife at the time. And Robert's, you know, kind of wants to pass her off to his, you know, his cartoonist buddies. And Trina hears about, and she's not happy about that. Trina hears about it, comes swooping in and says, why don't you come and live with me? I need a roommate. So they become friends. And then sometime later, Sandy comes out as a lesbian and moves into a gay hippie commune in San Francisco. And so Trina does a story about it for Women's Comics number one called Sandy Comes Out. It's a 3-page comic. And, you know, Sandy actually kind of co-wrote part of it. But it's the first story about a lesbian, essentially, that's kind of told in a literary fashion, you know. But it's done by a straight woman. So in these days of kind of early identity politics, that was not necessarily so cool. So Mary Wings and Roberta Gregory also, but Mary Wings did reacted first. She sees this and says, okay, well, a lesbian needs to tell the story of coming out, you know, and go into the emotional side and the spiritual side of it. So she creates Come Out Comics in 1972. three, in the folding and stapling it in the basement of a radical women's karate cooperative in Oregon, and sells it as a mail order for $1 a piece. So the early lesbian comics were not only coming from. And then those early lesbian comics were then started to kind of move into the kind of women's comics collectives and Tits and Clits and these other. The lesbian comics in particular have a history of having to carve out their territory not only among from gay men but also from straight women. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons, for example, later on there's the Dyke Strippers is a collection in the 90s by Roz Warren that collects this huge collection of lesbian comics. It's really quite amazing. And it was really created in response to Twisted Sisters, which was Diane Newman's book that collected all these kind of early women's comics and feminist comics and didn't include any lesbian comics. So lesbian comics kind of get pushed from both sides, but I will say that in the 90s in particular there was this really amazing scene of lesbian comics, and it was a really kind of the golden age of lesbian comics, and I think probably the best material being done in queer cartooning was in that scene. So lesbians get pushed into a corner and they come out with the best shit, so
it's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
Also want to kind of make acknowledgement of a couple other things that have come out recently, other gay anthologies, because it's interesting. Like, we've got this kind of historical narrative, and then we also have Gay Genius that Annie Murphy put together, and it's really interesting to see kind of this, I don't know what the term I want to use for, but really like a lot of different work kind of reflecting these different aspects of the community, and it's interesting because they are very different work. Yeah, Gay Genius, completely different from this. It's contemporary. It's dirty. It's very art house based. It's very activist based. I'm trying to think of the other one. Then
it's also very trans oriented. It's very, it's very gender queer. It's very kind of against gender binaries, which is stuff that kind of happens later. Mm-hmm. There's some moments of trans comics that happen earlier, but really it's not until the early 2000s that you start seeing really, out trans comics. And then by now, with Annie Murphy putting out that book, it's not only is it has a lot of trans creators, but really kind of focusing on the kind of blurring of gender boundaries and in a really modern, contemporary way. And it has a very different flavor, both artistically and thematically from the earlier work.
And it's also interesting, like, looking at trans creators specifically. It's a lot, I don't want to say easier now, but there's more visibility for trans creators. There's a lot more work coming out. And I think there's really a challenge because of stigma in the past. Folks like Catherine Jones, formerly Jeffrey Jones, who can kind of see just how this kind of marginalization went towards just a loss of health and a loss of work.
And there's still tremendous obstacles. If anyone gets oppression, there's no question. So I think in a lot of ways, trans creators now are kind of doing what the kind of early lesbian creators were doing in the 70s. Mary Wings had never heard the word lesbian until she was 19, right? So then she sees this comic, Sandy Comes Out, and she had realized that she was a lesbian as soon as she heard the term. And then she comes into this identity, sees this comic produced by Trina Robbins, and decides, I'm going to do my own lesbian comic. Boom. I'm going to make sure that other young women never have to go through what I went through. And they know who they are. They can see it. They have a guide. And I think, people like maybe Christine Smith, for example, now, who's doing The Princess. It's an all-ages trans comic it's a comic about a young trans girl. And she's basically showing, portraying this trans girl in this kind of non-pathological way for other trans children to kind of see this and say, oh, there is someone like me out there. And it's not pathological. So she's kind of doing what Mary Wings did back in the 70s. So there's, trans creators have it's been a wonderful explosion, but it's a big fight.
And I think some of that explosion too has happened just because of technology and the internet. Like, like before we had game magazines, we would mail order stuff to each other. Like, we would mimeograph dirty comics, or we would mimeograph like a cartoon that we thought was funny and gay, and we would send it to our friends secretly. And then we got newspapers and magazines so we could pick it up and look at it, right? Mm-hmm. And so then we had more access. More people could access that than they could access your mailbox.
Yeah.
But now everybody can go and look at your website or, like, check out your webcomic or whatever, right?
So. Yeah, so I mean, Mary Wing's doing that Come Out Comics and doing it mail order out of this, you know, basement of a karate cooperative is really different than, I mean, she's going to reach a far, far fewer people than Christine Smith, who's doing a webcomic.
No, exactly.
It's just because of the technology. That's right.
I totally realize I'm such a bad host today. I got to mention, one of the reasons Justin's in town is tonight you're going to be at Lucky's Comics.
I will indeed.
At between 23rd and 24th in Maine. Mm-hmm. Maine and 24th. From 6 o'clock to about 8 o'clock.
Yep.
Doing a signing, book launch for No Straight Lines.
You bet.
I love Lucky's Comics. You should too. And make sure you go out there tonight. Before all the Pride weekend madness begins.
I might even sing for you if you come.
Wouldn't sing for us, but you'll sing for them.
No, I sing in private. when it's not recorded.
You never know what I may sneak in.
It's true. You never know. You never know. Cameras are everywhere.
There is actually one up there. You see that,
you
guys?
Go. There you go. See?
They're keeping a watch on us. A reminder, it is Justin Hall and Ken Bozum I'm talking to about the anthology No Straight Lines, Four Decades of Queer Comics. We're talking a bit about the kind of work that's coming out now, and there's a couple of creators that really stick out to me in this book, continuing on the trans topic. The first is Joey Allison Sayers, and her Springtime one-page strip is amazing.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite one-page comics ever made. It's phenomenal. And I knew I wanted to start off the section with that. You know, it needed to, bam, start. In the same way that the previous section was a punch in the gut about AIDS and the horror of this plague, you know, the last section, I wanted to be hopeful. I wanted to be this emergence of a new identity. I wanted to be this remarkable, wonderful strip that's wordless and just beautiful.
Yeah.
Joey's amazing.
Do you want to tell folks a little bit about this report?
Yeah, so it's how many panels? It's like, let me see here, flip to
8 or something.
That's a standard grid. Let's see here. Okay, so it's called Springtime. It was in 2008, and it's just a 6-panel grid, very simple, and it's just her kind of looking forward at the camera, and her breasts are slowly growing. And at the bottom, when she looks down, she sees her breasts have grown, and she simply goes, "Yay!" And it's just, oh my god, it's brilliant.
And the other person who is one of the creators I'm most excited about right now is Edie Fake.
Yeah.
And I've read the part of the stuff that you had here, but the other thing I hadn't read, I read the stuff with the food and the other strip, which is like about his anxiety around gender and stuff. And I think he's one of those creators which I really want to highlight right now, which is who's creating some of the most artistically forward personal works out there. Gaylord Phoenix is amazing from Secret Acres, as well as the new Thickness anthology, which we were talking a little bit about before the during the music break, which the third one has Edie in it, and I can't get his name right.
Gengoro Tagame.
There we go.
who I will say, we were just talking about this. I will plug that Chip Kidd is going to be doing designing and producing a book with Picture Box of both of Gengoro Tagame and also of Bada, which is Bada is the gay, Japanese gay male comics made by gay men for gay men, as opposed to Yaoi, which are made by women for female audience. And it's a very underground comics culture in Japan, and has never been translated into English before. So this is a big deal. I'm very excited about that. But Thickness actually did it first in this brief little story.
Thank you, Ryan Sands. Check it out, thickness.me. No,
but yeah, I mean, Edie's amazing, and I'm really looking forward to how he kind of continues forward with different explorations and of identity and it's a very contemporary take on it. I mean, I think it has a different flavor from the early stuff in this book, from the stuff being done in the 70s and 80s.
It's it's like I said, very kind of artistically advanced in way, especially just like with that eye.
And it's tricky, I mean, just speaking as an editor, it's tricky to kind of take stuff like that and figure out a way to excerpt it. I mean, there's a lot of people in here that I was not able to put in that I really would love to have in the book, but it just, their work doesn't necessarily excerpt well. So especially a lot of the kind of art house stuff, it doesn't necessarily excerpt well. The longer form narratives, graphic novels, I try to stay away from unsatisfying excerpts, basically. And that really, left out a lot of really fantastic material.
I think it's also, one thing which is really nice that you do with this is that there's nothing obvious. Like, you don't have an excerpt, say, from
Fun Home.
Or Howard Cruz's
Stuck Rubber Baby.
Yeah. You know, like, something as me, as someone who's read a lot of comics. Too many comics, some might say. And
we wouldn't say that.
Thank you. but it's a lot of new work. As a reader.
So you I'm actually interested in hearing from both of you guys. Had you seen most of the work? I mean, how much of the work had you already seen that was in this book?
Not a lot. Not a lot. Some of the newer stuff, like I know Eric Amon's stuff, like even that one Edie fake story, I don't know the other stuff I have in a mini.
Yeah.
But it's also like kind of telling of where my stuff is at, where I'm not necessarily reading gay comics.
Right.
And I think that's,
I actually found I recognize more of the older stuff.
Yeah, see, I would, because you actually have an interest in that kind of history and that kind of material. And I think there is a shift where what's happening now is that queer narratives and comics are being kind of now dovetailing into independent and underground materials of all kinds, which is wonderful. But the earlier stuff was really in its own bubble. I mean, that's one of the things that was, I think, really important about this collection is that I'm trying to spotlight a really, really marginalized artistic scene. I mean, it was a marginalized art form and then marginalized within that, where most of the stuff never showed up in comic book stores. They were mostly, were published by gay publishers, serialized in gay newspapers, and sold in gay bookstores.
Or like I said before, that you were like mail ordering photostats of something to somebody, like mimeograph, crank, old copies of stuff.
Exactly. And some of the queer punk scenes, where you just, so this stuff never really even made it into the rest of the comic book world. So, and some of it was,
Alison Bechdel never went to a Comic-Con until she did Fun Home. After how many years of doing Dykes Watch Out For, which is like the Peanuts of gay comic strips.
Yes. So she actually came to Ape in 2004, I believe. And it was the first year I did the queer comics panel. I've been running a queer comics panel there every year. And she came that year, and it was the, she walks in, and here's one of the most accomplished cartoonists in the world, and she had never been to a comic book convention before, ever.
Wow.
And it was just this shocking kind of, you realize how disconnected the queer comics world was.
Well, I even find it weird, like when I have a table at a con, I find it weird because I don't know how to describe it exactly. Even it's like this weird sort of like subtextual conversation that's going on where you'll see people come up to the table and they'll want to connect and they think that, there should be a connection because there's this comic thing in common. But then if there's any sort of rainbow thing on the table or like anything that makes it overt that I'm gay, then you can see in their eye, they're like, I sort of want to like you and connect, but I feel kind of weird about that. So I feel like I should stand back here so I'm not accused of being liked by being near you. But I also kind of want to know, but I like... it's sort of a weird thing. It's like we should connect because we're geeks and we have that in common, but then this other thing keeps us apart.
Well, I think it's a particular dilemma of the modern, of the contemporary queer cartoonist, right? Like, how do you decide to assimilate and try to, stake out a stand in the kind of larger comics world, or do you try to find your niche? And I think of in particular, there's two creators that kind of exemplify that to me in the book. One is John Macy, who again did this Telly and Camille adaptation, which is just beautiful and extraordinary, and it's about queer history and it's about gay sex and it's about and he basically says, unless you have overt sex in your comics, then you're betraying your gay identity, because you're somehow ashamed of it if you're not going to have that. You know, so he's very much about speaking to other gay men and kind of, you know, creating queer identity and culture through comics. Then you also have someone like Ed Luce, who's doing kind of queer bear comics, but he doesn't ever call them bears, doesn't ever kind of... They're absolutely meant to be accessible by everyone.
And they're hilarious.
And they're hilarious. And they are accessible by, like, you know, straight people and, you know, women and, like, I mean, everyone loves Wovable Loaf, you know. So it's... He's going for a completely different, you know, attempt. And it's interesting because he actually, before he was a cartoonist, he was a fine art painter. And he actually did all erotic stuff about, like, cruising parks and stuff like this. So, which is really funny because his reputation now is this kind of, like,
you know, sweet,
jovial, like, PG-13, like, kind of guy. And, you know, his actual artistic background is not that. But he decided when he came into comics that he was going to make comics that were going to be queer but accessible. And that is possible. This is the first time that that's possible. In the past, his work would have been absolutely marginalized. And now it's, we'll see. You know, it's just opening up now. Mm-hmm. And it's same with the Edie Fake. You know, it's just possible now for him to branch out.
Just a reminder, folks, I'm talking to Justin Hall in Cambosum, and Justin will be at Lucky's Comics Night from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock at Main and 24th. We're just near the end of the hour. We've got about 4 minutes left. For folks outside of Vancouver, what are some other things you've got going on in the near future as far as book events?
Going down to do a little Northwest thing, going down to Seattle and to Portland. I'll be in Portland doing an event at Floating World Comics on Thursday
the 9th.
Thank you. Thursday the 9th from 6 to 8. And I'll be joined by Robert Tripto, who is the one of the editors of Gay Comics Anthology, Erica Moen, who did the Dar webcomic, and Von Frick, who's a really amazing early queer cartoonist who did some great work. And we'll be doing readings and signings there. That'll be fun. And then I'll be up signing with Fantagraphics during Geek Girl Con in Seattle. So we're excited about that.
Very nice.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to come in here.
Thank you for doing this. And thank you for having an official Pride version of Inkstuns and celebrating.
It'll be rainbow stamped.
There you go.
But not inaccessible.
There we go. And reminder, folks, the book is No Straight Lines. And for CanCon, it has a beautiful cover by the always charming Maurice Villacoop.
I was actually impressed with your CanCon. There's actually 4 or 5 people in there that are Canadian.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, there's Steve McIsaac. And
Steve McIsaac. Well, he's lived here and he dated somebody here. I think he lived here at one point.
Yeah.
Leanne Franson.
But no Rand Holmes.
Yeah. No, well, there's tiny... I know, I was worried about the Rand Holmes when I was looking at the preview online. I'm like, where's Rand Holmes? There's like a tiny one in the front there, though, so that's okay.
Yeah, it's tricky because that Harold Head thing is so amazing, but it is pretty erotic.
Very
it's actually pretty much pretty the definition of erotic.
And you can get it in another Fantagraphics book.
Yes, you can.
That's true.
That's true.
Yeah. There we go.
I do
without black boxes, as it was originally published in the Straight.
That's right.
They weren't gonna run the Straight unless they put the black boxes on.
Oh dear. Okay, now I'm gonna try this again. We're gonna play music, and hopefully it works. Have I got this right? All right, I'm gonna play some hidden cameras. Yeah, there we go. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We don't make a